Coming up on Fronteras, the 2013 Anti-Torture Award recipient went back to his native Rwanda after the genocide there to help people cope.
To talk, to think, to feel, to share, and then to see if it is possible to overcome from a crazy situation.
We'll hear about an award by the Hopi Foundation in Arizona for people who work with victims of torture. Also, imagine studying for years to become a doctor, and you finally make it. And then you come here, and you can't practice your profession. It takes more years of tests and thousands of dollars before you can practice again. That's what faces foreign doctors when they come to the U.S. Coming up, refugee medical professionals and the mountains they climb, but first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among seven public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. City leaders in Phoenix are trying to follow the example of their neighbors in the Southwest that have successfully established a business presence in Mexico. From Phoenix, Jujafi Block reports the city council could approve opening a trade office in Mexico's capital as early as next week.
Last spring, Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton visited San Antonio's trade office in Mexico City. It's one of three offices the Texas city has in Mexico, and they've helped to build a vibrant cross-border business relationship between San Antonio and Mexico. Now Stanton says establishing a permanent presence in Mexico will help Phoenix catch up. Stanton says Mexico is already an important trade partner for Phoenix businesses, but there's a lot of room to grow.
The other states around us, Texas and California, are doing more, and it's, you know, as mayor, I'm always going to act in the best interest of my local economy, and increasing trade and tourism with Mexico is a big part of the future of our economy, so we're going to do this.
The state of Arizona doesn't have an office in Mexico's capital, but Stanton says he'd partner with other business groups in the state that are also trying to boost their presence across the border. In Phoenix, I'm Jude Jaffe Block.
While the federal government was under the shutdown and lawmakers wrangled over the nation's debt, the spotlight was certainly not on immigration reform. Still, hundreds marched in Phoenix on Monday to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office to protest the Obama administration's deportation policies. The march came days after a group of activists chained themselves to buses carrying immigrant detainees in Tucson and halted a court hearing there. As Jujafi Block reports, these activists are calling on the president to take administrative action on immigration as the chance of Congress passing a reform bill this year wanes.
For weeks, activists had been planning Monday's protest, which they said would shut down the ICE office here using peaceful civil disobedience. But on Monday, the ICE office was already shut down. A note on the gate said it would be closed from Friday until Monday. Federal officials did not respond to inquiries about why the office was closed and if it was because of the Columbus Day holiday. No buses carrying immigrant detainees came in and out of the facility all day, a fact that activists celebrated. In fact, the protesters skipped civil disobedience and avoided arrest and instead danced in front of the ICE office. They decorated the entrance with a banner that read, "Not one more deportation." Maria Landeros, an unauthorized restaurant worker and mother of three, was there. She says her husband was arrested in one of Sheriff Joe Arpaio's worksite raids last year, and the family was separated while he was held in ICE custody. That's why she wants to use her voice now with a message to the president. She says Obama can give us work permits the way he did for the students. She's referring to a program called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. The Obama administration in 2012 granted young people who came to the country illegally as children a temporary reprieve from deportation and two-year work permits. So far, Obama's publicly rejected the idea of broadening the program. But could it be legally done? UCLA law professor Hiroshi Motomura says in a limited way, yes.
I can see that the rationale for DACA applies not only to children, but to other people who are who are low priorities for deportation.
Motomura believes the benefit could be extended to other groups, such as relatives of veterans, nursing mothers, or people already waiting in line for an immigration benefit, to name a few. But not all 11 million immigrants in the country illegally. Yet suppose Congress gets to the point that it passes an immigration bill, and then there's a short lag before the president can sign it.
Then I think the president would be within his rights to say that during the time till he can sign the bill, that he's not going to deport anyone who would benefit from it.
Not everyone wants to see the president take more action on immigration on his own.
At this point in time, we think that's a bad idea.
John Shattuck is a former Arizona congressman who's now part of the Bipartisan Policy Center's Immigration Task Force in Washington, D.C. The group put out a statement last week denouncing the idea of the president extending DACA and circumventing Congress.
If an administrative solution were to come forward, a broader one than the current DACA program, we believe that would harm and perhaps retard or even preempt the passage of legislation.
But many of those protesting on Monday said they can't wait anymore because some 1,100 people are deported every day. Alejandro Cáceres is an activist visiting from Austin, Texas.
This is not a one-time event. I do not believe that we can ignore the reality of our community, and that is deportation. I do believe that this will be echoed and will be replicated everywhere else in the United States.
Replicating this everywhere may be a bit ambitious, but protesters do expect more demonstrations in other cities. In Phoenix, I'm Jude Jaffe Block.
For years now, the southwestern United States has been crippled by drought. At the beginning of summer in New Mexico, that meant dry, brittle landscapes. Several communities ran out of water. KUNM's Rita Daniels reports that now hundreds of vulnerable towns are trying to avoid that from ever happening again.
The village of Wagon Mound is smack dab in the middle of New Mexico's sprawling eastern plains. With a population somewhere around 300, the community's been drawing its water from a natural spring that gushes up from the ground about a mile from town. Patrick Lopez is the water superintendent there.
This is the actual spring that the main line is tapped into, and it goes all the way down the canyon past a water station and then directly to the tank, and it's gravity fed.
Lopez says earlier this year, when he opened the main line to fill the tank in town, he noticed a big drop in the amount of water bubbling out of the spring, which was unusual. But the giant red flag came the day after, when the town's tank was filled, the spring stopped flowing completely.
There was a day the spring didn't come back.
The following day, the water did start flowing again, but because this is the only water source for the village, the reality that it could just vanish was terrifying. Lopez says the water levels dropped more than a foot and a half in just a month.
I really don't look forward to the day when you come up here and don't see but maybe a foot of water. That would be sad, but it could happen.
In fact, this summer, the wells in three New Mexico towns dried up and water had to be trucked in. Ryan Flynn is the secretary of the State Environment Department.
When we started seeing these communities run out of water, why is this occurring?
It turns out there's more than 250 mostly rural communities scattered throughout the state that rely on a single source.
If you're relying on only one single supply of water, if there was an event, you're really in a tough spot because you don't have any other options.
Those tough spots can be caused by drought, contamination, or just aging leaky infrastructure. And for the most part, he says, people don't even think about where their water comes from.
You know, you think as long as the water is flowing, everything's good.
Wagon Mound has teamed up with the state's Drinking Water Bureau to develop a plan. People are cutting back on their water usage. Residents can even go on supervised tours of the spring to see for themselves where the water that flushes their toilets actually comes from. Dennis McQuillan works for the state, helping towns protect their water source. He says across the Southwest, more water is being pumped out of the aquifers than nature is putting back in. Up at Wagon Mound Spring, he's been taking electrical conductivity readings to gauge the health of the aquifer that feeds it. McQuillan inserts a gadget that looks like a thermometer into the water.
Let me just run a couple to see what we get. I'm measuring the electrical conductivity of the water, which is a measure of the electrolytes in the water, in the total dissolved solids or the mineral content. And quite often what we'll see, as aquifers are being depleted, the conductivity will go up. The reading I just measured was 447 microsiemens per centimeter.
Despite the spring's lower levels, McQuillan says that conductivity reading has more or less flatlined, which is a good thing. Driving back to the village, McQuillan spots a windmill off in the distance and asks Patrick Lopez, the village's water superintendent, about it.
So is that another spring there at 11 o'clock?
There's a windmill there, and there might be a spring there as well.
Well, that would be a good one to sample and measure. Mm-hmm.
McQuillan says a proper hydrogeological investigation is going to involve sampling every possible water source in the region, even that distant windmill. Part of Wagon Mound's goal is to come up with a secondary source of water so that if their spring goes dry, there's a plan B. In Albuquerque, I'm Rita Daniels.
There's still more fronteras coming up. The hurdles foreign doctors face when they come to the U.S., refugee medical professionals, and the mountains they climb. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. When Tijuana police cleared out the canal that borders the U.S. in early August, hundreds of deported migrants who had camped there were evicted, and many took up residence in a nearby plaza. Now, 2 months later, reporter Jill Replogle says that squatters camp has become a virtual village.
It looks a bit like the Occupy Wall Street camp in New York City, except more organized. Dozens of mostly identical pup tents are lined up in rows around Tijuana's Plaza Constitucion, just a few blocks from the city's central tourist district. More than 600 migrants who've been deported from the U.S. are now living in this part protest camp, part homeless shelter. A group of deported migrants from Mexicali, who call themselves Ángeles Sin Fronteras, or Angels Without Borders, helped set up the camp. This morning, Javier Reyes, who used to work in Bakersfield, is manning the intake table. Reyes tells a young man from Guatemala to come back in the evening to claim a spot in a tent. Between 14 and 16 deported migrants show up every day, Reyes says. Camp leaders organize cleaning crews and security details, but they admit the camp has its problems, mostly fights and some drug use. In any case, they don't plan on staying here indefinitely. They have a bigger goal. A hotel, Reyes says, a shelter for a lot of migrants, not just 20 or 30, like most of the other shelters in town. Mexicali has such a place, an abandoned hotel that a local philanthropist rented a few years back and then invited deportees to occupy. The Tijuana squatters don't expect authorities will let them camp in the plaza much longer. In Tijuana, I'm Jill Replogle.
Here's something you don't think about when you get into a taxi. Your driver could be a doctor. Many refugee medical professionals have to ditch their white coats for blue collars when they first arrive in the United States. KPBS reporter Megan Burks in San Diego looks at why they have such a tough time getting into the U.S. healthcare industry, despite the need for more doctors and nurses.
Najwan Alani flips through a tattered study guide for the first phase of the U.S. medical licensing exam.
Sometimes I wrote a song just to put the name of any disease or any medicine in a song to remind myself.
After she used the workbook to study for and passed the test in 2011, it's less a book and more a stack of pages saturated with highlighter ink. But Alani keeps it as a souvenir to commemorate her first stop in a years-long and nearly $10,000 journey to practice medicine again. The Iraqi refugee spent 7 years as a primary care physician in Iraq and Jordan. In the United States, she's starting at what seems like square one. Foreign-trained doctors must pass American licensing exams and compete for residency positions with fresh-faced medical school graduates before becoming full-fledged doctors again in the U.S. Alani's experience treating shrapnel wounds and delivering babies in a war zone doesn't put her at the front of the line.
I faced like a case of delivery without any electricity. I need just a single flashlight to make this mom pass the delivery safely.
Alani says she and her colleagues worked under intense pressure during the early years of the Iraq War. Medicine and supplies were limited. The streets surrounding the hospital were so dangerous her chief resident was killed on the way to work. Now in the U.S., she's confronting those experiences once more, translating them for cover letters and mock interviews.
In our circumstances, you face a lot of injuries, a lot of emergencies. This increases your skills and confidence and ability to work as a team.
The path is long, it's arduous, it's incredibly costly.
That's Sophie Cheatham. She's helping Alani navigate the U.S. job market. She runs the Bridge to Employment program through the International Rescue Committee facility. Each year, it offers grants and guidance to 75 foreign licensed medical professionals who want to get back into the healthcare industry. Some first take jobs as taxi drivers and cashiers when they arrive in the U.S.
They want nothing more than to find employment, to support their families, to lead self-sufficient lives, and so recertification isn't initially a priority for them.
Cheatham says her clients gain insight into the U.S. work culture through those early jobs. But for a nation already lacking about 16,000 primary care physicians, the benefit of having doctors drive people to the airport or run a checkout stand is less clear.
And what can I say? I mean, we need primary care physicians. Everybody knows that. And everybody says that.
Stephen Hayden heads UC San Diego's medical residency program. He says many of the nation's primary care residency positions go unfilled each year because the line of work isn't considered lucrative enough to pay down student debt. He says it might make sense to fast-track doctors like Alani, who's already expressed interest in practicing family medicine and whose schooling was paid for by the Iraqi government.
They will still have to complete a primary care residency of some sort. But, you know, especially given that some of these slots are more difficult to fill, I think it wouldn't be unreasonable to consider a program where these individuals would then fill some of those slots.
But streamlining the process for refugee doctors could be a tricky line to walk. Despite the trouble filling primary care residencies, Hayden says competition among U.S. med students is high.
Probably in about 2015, the number of U.S. graduates will exceed the number of first board residency slots that are available.
You click on the residency and fellowship. You start to select the specialty.
As Alani clicks through an online residency application system, she projects an unfaltering calmness. She says she doesn't mind being thrown into an overflowing applicant pool with graduates 10 years her junior.
In the medical field, you always feel like you are learning. To work with the people fresh graduated, it could be helpful for me and them. I can be helpful with my experience. They could be helpful with their fresh knowledge. I think we will be a good team together.
Alani will find out if she's matched with the residency program in March. Megan Burks, KPBS News.
On the Hopi lands in northern Arizona, an international group of healthcare workers gathered recently to honor the latest recipient of the Barbara Chester Award, given by the Hopi Foundation to those who work with torture victims. It's named after psychologist Barbara Chester, who developed the first treatment program in the U.S. for victims of torture and later worked as the director of the Hopi Center for Substance Abuse and Violence Prevention. Constance Devereaux attended the awards ceremony and has this report.
A Hopi blessing opens the ceremony. It is a brilliant October day. Under a blue Hopi sky, the San Francisco peaks sparkle frostily to the southwest. Honoring torture aid workers has deep significance for the Hopi, whose traditional creed embodies a commitment to peace, healing, and treating others with respect. Recognizing the same dedication in Barbara Chester led the Hopi Foundation to establish an award in her honor. Eyes squinting against the sun, Dr. Juan Almendares recounts a conversation with one of his torturers who told him,
"You know, we are going to kill you. We are going to take your skin. We are going to cut in pieces. We are going to maybe to use electricity, whatever." I say to him, "There is a difference between you and myself. You want to kill me. I want you to be alive."
Almendares was the 2001 recipient of the Barbara Chester Award. He treats victims of torture in his native Honduras and now serves on the selection committee for future award recipients. He has traveled to Hopi to take part in recognition of Dr. Nasin Munyandamutsa of Rwanda, the 2013 honoree. Munyandamutsa is a psychiatrist by training. He smiles wide, showing his teeth when he speaks. His eyes betray the pain of his past. In Switzerland, at the time of the Rwandan genocide, he returned to his village just days before it was destroyed, his family and neighbors massacred. The last time he saw his mother alive, she gave him this advice.
"Go and never come back."
Yet he did go back, after the genocide, offering a process of healing to victims. He provides a safe place, making it possible for them
to talk, to think, to feel, to share, and then to see if it is possible to overcome from a crazy situation.
He's done amazing work. I think it was a unanimous choice. He's worked in a country with a very difficult history and seems to have made a very big difference.
Shari Eppel of Zimbabwe was the first recipient in 2000 of the Barbara Chester Award. In the dangerous world of torture victim aid, she sees the award as a safety charm.
There's always a protective element in being an award winner. It raises your profile in a protective way so that maybe the government thinks twice before coming after you because they know that you've got, you know, people around the world who know about you.
According to Human Rights Watch, more than 100 nations in the world actively engage in torture. The Barbara Chester Award embodies the Hopi principles of Sumi Nangwa, helping others in times of need, Hita Nangwa, taking initiative, and Hiepsi, respect for life. The very foundation of human rights, yet values increasingly forgotten in today's world, even nearly 30 years after the passage of the UN Convention Against Torture.
Once and for all, the United Nations identified at the international level, here's how we define torture, here's what governments must do to stop torture. And governments around the world, you know, signed on to that.
Michael O'Reilly is Deputy Executive Director of Amnesty International USA.
So here we are 30 years later, and we're starting to see, you know, disturbing trends. Over the past decade, there has been a rollback on those gains that were made.
Despite the challenges, Dr. Munyanda Mutsa finds hope and friendship in Hopi culture that will continue to inspire his work.
How they love their culture, how they love people, how they're open to people coming from far.
In Chichotzmavi, Arizona, Constance Devereaux reporting.
That wraps up Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. We're online at fronterasdesk.org. For headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at Fronteras Desk. You may subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thank you for listening.